Hello, this is Carol Bond reading with you today the Decatur Herald and Review, dated June 14th, 2016. We'll begin with local news on page 3, and this is the headline, Search for Drowning Victim Takes Toll, and the dateline is Shelbyville. The article was written by Sharon Barraclough for the Herald and Review. From about 10:30 p.m. Saturday until daybreak Sunday morning, a few volunteer members of the Shelby County Dive Team and a team from the Illinois Department of Natural Resources moved their boats slowly around 9th Street Beach area of Lake Shelbyville. They were using sonar to search for a Decatur man who had disappeared while swimming around 4:30 p.m. Saturday. The body of the swimmer, 21-year-old Brandon R. Breeze, was discovered after 11 a.m. Sunday. Quote, "It was rough," dive team Captain Austin Pritchard said. "The visibility underwater at the lake is 6 to 12 inches. It's hard to see anything, so you go by feel." Almost a dozen agencies responded to the 911 call for help. Friends said Breeze and others were swimming outside the designated swimming area near the Lake Shelbyville Dam when Breeze and another man became fatigued. The other swimmer made it back to the safe area with assistance, but Breeze disappeared. Quote, "We used sonar to find a couple of targets and sent divers, but neither one was correct," Pritchard said. "Then we went back and interviewed witnesses and tried to get a more exact location of where he was last seen." Assisting in the search were rescue workers from Effingham County, Shelby County law enforcement agencies, and fire and rescue squads, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, and IDNR responded to the call. Red Cross and other volunteers provided assistance for workers and searchers and family members in the 90-plus degree heat. Divers were called out of the water late in the evening, but Pritchard and others continued to use sonar to search for Breeze overnight. Divers returned to the water early Sunday morning, and Breeze was found about 11:30 a.m. An investigation into the accident is continuing. Pritchard said swimmers sometimes overestimate their own abilities and may have trouble judging distances on lake waters when they leave the designated swimming area. Quote, "The first and most important thing we want people to know is to stay inside the swimming area," he said. "The second is if you are not a strong swimmer, either wear or have floating with you a flotation device to keep you above water." The lengthy search was emotionally hard on family members and friends waiting on the beach and on the rescue workers. "It's hard on everyone," Pritchard said. "Emergency personnel don't talk about it in front of everyone. But when we get behind closed doors, we'll talk about it. There's not going to be a good ending, and it's tough." Also on page 3, we find this education article written by Valerie Wells, and the headline is Washington School Demolition Sparks Bittersweet Memories. Though Washington School closed for good in 2005, watching it start to fall to demolition was still a sad occasion for those who have memories there. "Oh, how sad," said Chris Oyer, who worked there as librarian. quote, "I loved that stately old building. I spent 23 wonderful years there in the library, my second home. But the memories of the fantastic family of teachers, staff, students, and parents will live on, for it truly was a family." Quoting Susan McBride Moore, "I spent 21 years there. A great place to work. Breaks my heart. It was a beautiful building." The Decatur School Board made the suggestion to close Washington during the time the Hope 6 project was in its planning stages, when Hope Academy had yet to be built. Both Washington and Durfee School's former building at the corner of Jasper and Grand were in need of more expensive repairs than the district could afford, and Washington was not compliant with state health life safety codes. The district's business director, the late Martin Getty, said at the time that the cost to bring the building up to codes would exceed the cost of replacing the building. Once Hope was built and ready to open in August 2005, the district redrew boundaries and closed Washington. The new boundaries displaced 42% of students in the district, moving them to new buildings, and increased the number of magnet schools, adding Hope and Durfee, which moved to West Grand Avenue. Washington was built in 1925 to replace Jackson and Jasper schools, whose students were assigned to the then new school. It was dedicated on February 12, 1926, with Principal C.W. Smith at the helm, a teaching staff of 28, and 1,000 students. The building also included 3 health rooms for students, quote, who need special attention on account of delicate physical condition, as a H&R clipping from the time related. The Parent Teacher Associations of Jackson and Jasper were dissolved and reformed into a new Washington PTA, and a Liberty Bond bought by the mothers of Jasper students was turned over to Washington to pay for a fountain on the new school's grounds. The grounds cost the district in $1925 over $22,000, and the fireproof building was $250,828 minus the cost of terrazzo floors that were also part of the fireproof design. Fireproof is in quotes here. There was some minor controversy over naming the school Washington, as it's on the grounds of the old Johns family estate. But plans were already underway to build a junior high on those same grounds, and the school board was holding the Johns name in reserve for it. That building is Johns Hill Magnet School today. School Board member B.A. Butts served as principal of Washington for many years and said those years were among the most meaningful of his career. He still encounters students who have fond memories of their years there, too. Quote, "It is as though a part of my life and family is being torn down, and it is sad to go," he said. "So many wonderful memories are slipping into the past forever. We made an impact on lives, and the successes of the Washington students are living testimonials to the dedication and strength of the staff. I am sorry to see this iconic, vintage, historic 1925 school be torn down." The plan was always to tear down the building, said Mike Sodaroff, director of buildings and grounds, but district finances weren't adequate until now. Some of the proceeds of the 1% sales tax increase, which is dedicated to capital improvements, made it possible. All the debris will be removed or crushed and covered, so that if a future building project is planned there, the site will be ready. Several plans for the campus, that includes Johns Hill, are under consideration by the district, but nothing has been decided yet. There are four very dramatic pictures that go along with this story, and I'll do my best to describe them. One is an H&R file photo from 1931 showing the school is practically brand new. It says that Washington School was built to replace Jasper and Jackson schools. It opened in 1926 with the combined students of two former schools. That is a black and white photograph. Then there is a colored photograph showing I don't know the exact term. I will just call it a digger, a large John Deere machine scooping into the top of the front of the building, looking to take out large chunks. Then there are two additional photos. One is an interior that shows an old classroom exposed after a wall was torn down during the start of demolition work at the former Washington School Monday afternoon. So in this picture, we're looking through the building at the classroom. Finally, there's an H&R file photo from 1926 showing students at Washington School in 1926 study in the open air room in wool coats as one way to combat tuberculosis. Fresh air and careful attention to diet and exercise were used to lower the risk of contracting the deadly disease. And indeed, this picture shows the interior of a classroom where students are sitting to a table with pull-up chairs, and every one of them is wearing an identical coat with a hood, and they look to be gray, but they could of course be any color in this black and white photograph, which is a very interesting contrast to classrooms these days. On page 5, we find some of our columnists, and we'll begin with letters to Abby. Here's the first. Dear Abby, I'm the mother of two teenagers, ages 13 and 15. I am trying to teach them to do chores and help around the house, but all I get is attitude from them. I tried to explain that I didn't grow up with a dishwasher and I washed all the dishes by hand. Well, now that we have a dishwasher, they don't want to load or unload it either. I try not to spoil my kids, but I guess it's too late. Sometimes I get so frustrated that I just do the chores myself. What am I doing wrong as a parent? My kids are either on their iPhone or iPad or Xbox. They have a better childhood than I ever had, but they don't understand. It's hurtful when their response is, "Let me live," or "You don't understand anything," or "I can't wait to get out of the house and get away from you." This is very hurtful, and I guess I just needed to vent to someone other than my husband. Thanks for letting me. Signed, Stressed Out Mom. Here is Abby's answer. Dear Mom, you're welcome. Now, may I offer a suggestion? You should not be doing your teenager's chores for them. Instead, start instituting consequences if they shirk their responsibilities. An effective consequence would be to confiscate their iPhone, iPad, or Xbox if the chores aren't done when they're supposed to be. And if they talk disrespectfully to you, ditto. Here's the second letter. Dear Abby, my son's fiancé set their wedding date without asking me if I could make it. I recently took a job on the West Coast. As a campground manager and new employee, I can't get time off Labor Day weekend to fly back to the East Coast for the wedding. Labor Day is one of the big summer holidays for campgrounds. His fiancé has done other hurtful things in the past, and I can't help but doubt it was an oversight that I wasn't consulted before their wedding date was set. When I tried to talk to my son about it, I received the anticipated hostility I usually get from him. My question to you is, should I pay for their caterer? I have given this son so much money over the years that I can't help but believe he's a user. Advise, please. And the letter is signed Excluded Out West. Dear Excluded, if your son had wanted you to be at his wedding, you would have been consulted before the date was set. His fiancé didn't consult you because that is probably the way your son wanted it. Under the circumstances, you should not pay for any of the wedding expenses. If you feel you must do something, send them a congratulatory card wishing them a lifetime of happiness together. Period. Wow. The next letter is about butting in. Dear Abby, if I am standing in line waiting for a friend to arrive at a store that's about to open for sale, when my friend arrives, is it okay for her to join me where I've been holding the spot, or should we move to the back of the line so customers behind us don't feel like she is butting in? And the letter signed, No Buts, about it. Dear No Buts, lines for sales can be long, and people sometimes wait many hours to get into the stores. According to Emily Post, quote, courteous people never break into line. It might be diplomatic to ask the person standing in back of you if he or she minds if your friend joins you. Some might object, others not. Here's a letter to Dr. Roach today. Dear Dr. Roach, I am a man in my 80s, and in the past 3 years, I have had 4 or 5 incidents when one of my wrists became excruciatingly painful, with some inflammation and slight reddish coloring. I cannot correlate these incidents with prior physical or exercise activities, except that the most recent incident occurred the day after I may have overdosed on chocolate. Would this be an incident of pseudo-gout, an accumulation of calcium pyrophosphate crystals? To treat this condition, I have been prescribed Celebrex, hydrocodone, and prednisone. I prefer not using Celebrex or a narcotic, and your recent column advised against using prednisone since steroids can cause poor blood flow to bone tissue. I am on lisinopril and warfarin, so I am limited to certain analgesics and anti-inflammatory agents. What agents would you recommend? And this person signs his letter simply Anon. Here's Dr. Roach's answer. While it is possible that those incidents might be pseudogout, which you correctly note is due to calcium pyrophosphate crystals in joints, it might be gout, uric acid crystals, or even a different cause, say arthritis or tendonitis. Before committing to a course of treatment, I'd recommend you get a diagnosis. Both gout and pseudogout can be definitively diagnosed by taking a sample of joint fluid during an attack. Pseudogout, but not gout, can usually be diagnosed by X-ray. A rheumatologist is the expert on sorting out joint pains. By the way, I couldn't find that chocolate is likely to cause either gout or pseudogout. Dark chocolate is thought by some authorities to be helpful, but milk chocolate is not. We turn now back to page 3 for the briefs column, and here is the first. A Decatur driver with an overheating car Sunday discovered an unusual cause when she took it into the shop. Her vehicle had been shot. Written police reports said mechanics found a bullet hole in the passenger side headlight cover, and the bullet had hit a glancing blow to the radiator. The 25-year-old female driver told police she had come home at 4 a.m. from a bingo session and had no idea where or when her car had been shot at. The next item is about rock throwing. Police arrested 4 teenage boys Sunday night and charged them with vehicular endangerment after accusing them of throwing rocks at vehicles from a Decatur Railroad overpass. Written reports said one 48-year-old driver had a 16-inch long crack put in his windshield about 9:30 p.m. as he drove under the overpass on Oakland Avenue near West McKinley Avenue. He reported the damage, and a patrol officer in the area quickly caught the alleged rock throwers, 3 aged 14 and 1 16-year-old. Police say there are 7 other reports of rock throwing related to this incident. Here's the next item about city vehicles. Police are investigating after 2 vehicles belonging to the City of Decatur Engineering Department were vandalized. Police reports say their back windows were broken out by being pelted with rocks, which also did other damage, while the vehicles were parked at Gary K. Anderson Plaza on Thursday night. Then, burglary suspect arrested. Police say an alleged Decatur thief with a drug habit was caught red-handed as she hunted vehicles to burglarize in a grocery store parking lot. Sworn statements claim eyewitnesses had told police they saw the 50-year-old suspect trying vehicle doors Friday night in the lot of the Kroger store at 3070 North Water Street. The witnesses say they saw her climb into one car through the back hatch before moving on to try another vehicle as patrol officers approached and took her into custody. Police say packages of cigarettes taken from the car she entered were still in her possession. The subject was searched, and police alleged they found a pipe used for smoking marijuana. The suspect was jailed on burglary possession of drug paraphernalia charges. Also this about a fight incident. A woman who allegedly beat up her boyfriend's female roommate is being sought by police. Reports said the suspect went to her boyfriend's apartment in the 100 block of South Edward Street on Friday evening, but he wasn't there, and she then got into a dispute with the 30-year-old roommate. Police alleged the suspect punched the victim in the face and head, and she sustained a cut and other injuries after they wrestled on the floor. The suspect, about 30, is being sought on battery charges. The next item has to do with computer theft. Police arrested a 12-year-old Decatur boy and charged him with stealing and selling his grandmother's computer so he could buy marijuana. Police reports say the child lives with his grandmother and took the computer from her home Friday night. The computer is valued at more than $600. And finally this. To ensure safety in the home canning process, pressure canner lid gauges should be tested annually. The University of Illinois Extension is providing free gauge testing at local Extension offices. Over time, a dial gauge's calibration can become inaccurate. If the pressure is even slightly lower than recommended, the internal temperature of the food will not be high enough to kill all the bacteria, and harmful toxins can build up and cause illness or death. To check a pressure canner lid, drop it off at the nearest Extension office. To find the nearest office, there is a website to check. It's extension.illinois.edu/state/calendar. We're going to take a short break now and return with the second half hour of the June 14th issue of the Decatur Herald and Review. Please stay tuned for the second half hour.